So that there's been everybody, there was a significant party objected. You got this now? They objected, first of all, to this idea of being a pagan city. Secondly, they objected specifically to the gymnasium because of the nudity, the idolatry connected with it. The holy games, by the way, were held in honor of the gods, so there was a religious objection as well as the nudity. Got this? There was what we would call the Olympic Games. These contests were religious festivals, really. And for the straw that broke the camel, that camel's back, was when they demoted a legitimate high priest and put Menelaus, who was a Benjaminite, as high priest. Boy, now Antiochus never could figure out why the Jews got so upset. He could, it didn't seem like a big thing to him. But in religious, there was strong objection to this. For instance, we read, this is reflected in the Second Maccabees. Let me read this to you. When Seleucus was dead, he had been succeeded by Antiochus, known as Epiphanes. Now, this Seleucus is another term for Antiochus III. He was Seleucus and Antiochus. That had about four different names. Jason, Onias' brother, obtained the high priesthood by corrupt means. He petitioned the king and promised him 360 talents in silver, and so forth. This was before Jason was deposed. The king agreed, as soon as he had seized the high priesthood, Jason made the Jews conform to the Greek way of life. I mean, Second Maccabees, it's in the Roman Catholic Bible. This is one of the apocryphal books that's in the Roman Catholic Old Testament. He set aside the royal privileges established for the Jews at the agency of John, the father of Eupolemus. Anyway, don't worry about that. He abolished the lawful way of life and introduced practices which were against the law, as the law of Moses. He lost no time in establishing a sports stadium at the foot of the citadel itself. What's the deed? This was a gymnasium, and all that went with it. He made the most outstanding of the young men assume the Greek athlete's hat, which was a wide-brimmed hat. It's been quite a scene to see these fellows participating in the nude with the 10-gallon hat on. Anyway, so Hellenism reached a high point with the introduction of foreign customs to the boundless wickedness of the impious Jason, no true high priest. They didn't even like, they didn't like Jason because he was a brother. And you can see, if they call Jason no true high priest, imagine what they call Menelaus. By the way, when Menelaus, we're going to see later, when Menelaus got in there, the Jews actually took up arms and had war within the city, within the country. As a result, the priests no longer had any enthusiasm for their duties at the altar. Not even the priests, but despised the temple and neglected the sacrifices. And in defiance of the law, they eagerly contributed to the expense of the wrestling school whenever the opening gong called them. And ring the gong, the wrestling competition, they would go. And even supported it financially. They placed no value on their hereditary dignity, as being Levites, born to the priesthood, but cared about everything for Hellenic honors. Because of this grievous misfortunes beset them. You know, God punished them. One of the themes of 2 Maccabees. And the very men whose way of life they strove after, they tried so hard to imitate, turned out to be their vindictive enemies. This is true. To act profanely against God's law is no light matter. It will become clear in due time. Josephus also talks about this. Do you enjoy hearing the original, the primary sources on? I think you read these secondary histories, but a lot of it's nice to go back here to read the material that the historians read to write their books, from which they write their books. I'm reading from the standard scholar. If you ever do any research in ancient history, the classics, the scholar's edition of all this is the famous Lowell Classical Library. This is the Roman Classical Library. It's a section of Josephus, but the Greek on one side and the English on the other. It's a standard scholarly translation. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the same general period, we read this. Let's see where I'm at here. Yes. About this same time, the high priest Onias, now, you know who Josephus is? The late first century Greek AD, who's writing history of his own people, for the sake of the Romans, by the way, justifying the existence of the Jews to the Romans.
About this same time, the high priest Ananias also died, and Antiochus gave the high priesthood to his brother, for the son, actually deposed him before that, but for the son whom Ananias had left was still an infant. We shall relate all the facts concerning this son in the proper place. And when the former high priest, Jesus, or Jason, rose against Menelaus, who was appointed after him, the populace was divided between the two, the Tobias being on the side of Menelaus, while the majority of the people supported Jason. What happened? Jason didn't like being thrown out of the high priesthood. So when Menelaus, an illegitimate priest, was put on in the high priesthood, Jason got up a rebellion. Now Jason was not into, he did not fight this battle on behalf of God. He fought on behalf of Jason. Anyway, but the result was the same. But the majority of the people supported Jason. Why? They liked Jason not particularly, but because they disliked having this illegitimate Benjaminite in the high priesthood. Yes.
Why did the Jews appreciate Jason more?
Well, because he was not really supposed to be the high priest either. The son of Onias was supposed to be the high priest. I mean, see, the Jews had a funny mind. They didn't care what kind of man was on there as long as he was had the right father.
There couldn't be a brother in Jason with line of marriage.
No. It was supposed to be a direct line of possible. Because Onias had a son. Jason, even though he was not quite as bad, was not supposed to be the high priest.
Was the high priest at the time of Jesus' death of the line of Aaron, or this Menelaus descendant?
No, they never had the Aaronic priesthood again. They were really sure. Essentially, it's always a continued debate among the Jews. Was the temple worship right because our high priest is not of the right line? And this is part of the background of the Hebrews, by the way, where he says our high priest is not of Aaron, doesn't have to be under the order of Melchizedek. Solve the whole problem. Anyway, was hard pressed by him. Menelaus and the Tobias withdrew, going to Antiochus, informed him that they wished to abandon their country's laws and the way of life prescribed by these, and to follow the king's laws and adopt the Greek way of life. Now, they knew, actually, Antiochus was determined. They said this is a good way to get him. Now, see, Menelaus, Antiochus was trying to make this a Greek city. Menelaus was his puppet. And so, what happened was, when Jason and many of the people actually took up arms against Menelaus and his followers, he realized that since he was not able to keep the peace, he would probably lose his office and Antiochus would replace him. But, so what they did, they went to Antiochus and said, you've got to help us. We want to promote this Greek way of life the way you do. They probably really didn't want to. They weren't interested in being grouped in the Hellenistic way of life. They probably didn't care much one way or the other. They probably just wanted to stay in power. This was their excuse. Accordingly, they petitioned him to permit them to build a gymnasium in Jerusalem. And when he had granted this, they also concealed the circumcision of their private parts in order to be Greeks. Interesting thing that they were, that some of these priests were even participating in the games, in the nude, and to appear, and the Greeks did not practice circumcision. And so in order to appear as Greeks, they went through a very painful surgery to, let's call it a epispasm, is a technical term, to reverse the circumcision, exceedingly painful, so that they could participate and appear as Greeks. That's how far they went. Giving up whatever other national customs they had, they imitated the practices of foreign nations. Period of great, great shame. And so the battle lines are drawn. You got this? Antiochus with his puppet Menelaus and the high priesthood Antiochus the Fourth, the Epimenes, a large faction in Jerusalem determined to the focal point of their objection is Menelaus and the high priesthood and the gymnasium and the Greek way of life in general. Now this is very important. You say, well, why, this isn't the time of Jesus. Well, it is. The background of it, for instance, I'll give you one of the many examples. We'll understand why Paul would work out of Antioch, if you understand this period. The other important thing,
those who represent the traditional or orthodox way of life, as opposed to the Hellenistic way of life, those who were trying to resist this, to overthrow Menelaus, to get rid of the gymnasium, this group of people were called the Hasidim, which means pious. And the Hasidims, the Hasidim, listen to me, if you get this in your notes, it's probably on a test. The Hasidim were the forerunners of the Pharisees. Out of the Hasidic movement came the Pharisees.
Who were they?
They were the party, the leaders of the party who wanted to hold out the traditional Orthodox Judaism, who wanted to resist this attempt to make Jerusalem a Greek polis or a Greek city.
Leaders of the Jason group?
Well, more or less. They were not the same as Jason. Jason was sort of figurehead. Interesting. Jason was eventually rejected by them, too. But Jason was just a troublemaker. Now, a very interesting thing happened. Now that the scene is set, there's bitter dissension. You got this? The Orthodox Jews are fighting the unorthodox Jews, the Hellenistic Jews, those who want to go along with this, led by Menelaus, and they're also hating Antiochus. In AD 170, Antiochus set on a campaign to, he wanted to extend his borders. He was always trying to take over Egypt. Once he got this part, he wanted the rest of it. Never did get it. But because Egypt was exceedingly wealthy. Egypt had gold, Egypt raised a lot of wheat. Egypt was you could always depend upon Egypt for food, because Egypt produced a lot of grain, and the beautiful part about it was that Egypt did not depend upon rainfall for grain. Every year you set your clock by the rising of the Nile. The Nile would rise, would fertilize the flats, you would dig the irrigation channels, you could always depend on it. But if you couldn't get grain anywhere else, you'd get it in Egypt. Unless the famine quickly wiped everything out. But remember Abraham? Before the days of Joseph, remember Abraham went down into Egypt because of famine. And he could buy grain there, but couldn't be anywhere else. Now there was a famine in the days of Joseph, but that was unusual. One of the reasons that the Egyptians had a hard time believing Joseph, when he said there's going to be 7 years of famine, that was the reason for Egypt. Well, anyway, Antiochus set out to take Egypt, and there, in 170 B.C., one of the great moments of history, I love this, it's arrogant Antiochus, who, you know, the Epiphanes, the great, who, keep in mind, as a boy, he had spent 12 years in Rome as a hostage, and he knew the Romans, he knew what they could do. His father had been defeated by the Romans when they, being encouraged by Hannibal, tried to invade Greece. He'd run the back of the Battle of Magnesia, defeated them, and exactly this great tribute. He gets down to Alexandria, and he's going to take Alexandria, the second stage of the Roman Empire. You got that? Alexandria. And the Roman legate, or envoy, didn't have a big army. The Roman envoy met him. Grand Antiochus had this army. The Roman legate didn't have a big army. Armed army. And he said to Antiochus, and he walked out to Antiochus, outside Alexandria. Great scene. He walks out to him and he draws a circle around him in the dirt. And he says to him, in the name of Rome, you cannot step out of that circle until you promise to go home. We'll let you off, we'll let you go home. You stay in that circle until you promise to go home. If you step out of that circle before you promise to go home, be war. And Antiochus, he knew who he was dealing with. He was dealing with Rome. And so he promised to go home. He's a good boy. And let him go. He was so mad, humiliated, that on the way back through, he raided Jerusalem, killed a lot of people, raided the temple treasury, but on his way back to Antioch. And Josephus tells about this. I don't take time to read it. I think that's hilarious. Can you imagine him standing out there in the dirt? The circle around him in the dust. And Rome telling him he can't step out of that circle until he promises to go home like a good boy. Yes.
Do you want to desecrate the temple?
Yes. We'll get to that. Now we come down to, and Jerusalem was in a state of revolt. He sacked Jerusalem on the way home. And by the way, that was in 178 B.C. This is a footnote. In 168 B.C., that was in 170 B.C. Then you come back with me in B.C. 2 years later, 168 B.C., at the famous Battle of Pydna, which is right here in Macedonia, on this map, Rome defeated the Macedonians, and for the Battle of Pydna, they'd already made a clear to Antiochus that he better do what they say. The Battle of Pydna is the destruction of the Macedonians, as the historians like to say, in 168 B.C. This is important because, see, Jesus lived and died of the Romans. In 168 B.C., the Mediterranean became a Roman lake. Before, it was not so. See, 2 years before, they had enough influence to keep Antiochus out of Egypt. But in 168, they defeated the Macedonians, and the Syrian Seleucid Empire was never again a great force. It's now Rome. Yes.
Was the Roman and Alexandria really circling around?
I think it was.
Oh, did
you? I read it yesterday. Refuted it, but I can't say his name. Isn't it good? Parthenel. He's just or something. I can't believe it.
Maybe
that
circle around him, because
that's when he was going to attack Egypt. Yeah,
he was going to attack
Egypt. See, the Romans. Romans were protecting Egypt. Yeah. The Romans, always treated Egypt as a special case. Rome had ruled Egypt, they never conquered Egypt.
Is that because they considered it their breadbasket?
Yes. The bank. So they always, now the Romans, Egypt, they didn't have to conquer, they would have, they had to, but Egypt capitulated to the Romans. But it was kind of a gentleman's agreement, that is, they never humiliated the Egyptians. Rome always was administered as a special case. And because, you see, why is this important? You see, was it maybe the Paul shipwreck? He was on a grain ship. Going where? To Rome. From where?
Egypt.
And so for all of his history, Rome was always very careful to Egypt. Rome was saying to Antiochus, keep your hands off. Keep your hands off. Antiochus did, yes.
I don't understand. They covered from that area there, and the Romans carried covered this area within the word Roman cover.
Well, see this map, this look at the date here, 185 B.C. This is 323 to 185. The period I'm talking about is after this. In other words, this was the Ptolemies were still, now note this, the Ptolemies were still the local kings of Egypt. But Rome exercise ultimate rule, but they, for instance, the most famous Ptolemy of all was who? Cleopatra. And Mark Antony made an alliance with her. We're going to talk about this later, the famous battle when Antony and Cleopatra made war against Augustus. And they combined their navies. But one, if I make one Roman, a Roman faction made an alliance with Egypt. So they were, the funny, it's hard to, we often think in terms of either or. Either Egypt was completely free, or you had a Roman governor there. It was neither. They had a modicum of freedom, yet Rome, you know, ultimately had the control. And so the Ptolemies maintained their rule. The Cleopatra is there almost 100 years later. She's still there. I mean, the Ptolemies are still there. She's the queen. But, you see, but any time Rome wanted to, they could have invaded. They didn't want to, because it was just not good business. It wasn't smart. The Romans were no dummy in that kind of administration. The Romans didn't conquer anybody that didn't have to. They didn't believe in conquering somebody who couldn't rule.
And Egypt was like a swamp, and something, you know, that is not geographically or physically, but Cyrus went to Egypt, and eventually it was just too big for him, ponderous. You see, it's for the same reason that the Romans never could really control this civilization. See, this civilization, this land, the culture there is old, deep, strong, hard,
big.
An invading army could go in, conquer the cities. See, it's one thing to conquer an army, it's something else to rule it. And this way of life is too deeply ingrained. In other words, the Romans knew that in order to really rule Egypt, they would have to destroy Egypt. Same thing was true of Persia. You got that? They would have to destroy it to rule it. If you destroyed it, you turn the goose that lays the golden egg. So they chose to keep a light rein on them, see. The threat was always there. But they never went in and destroyed each other. So foolish to do so. If they could have done it. See that the higher civilization tends to swallow the lower civilization. The older civilization tends to swallow the younger civilization. And for instance, Greece had a higher civilization than Rome, as far as culture is concerned. Therefore, let's say, note this. I put it this way, that the average Gentile citizen of the Roman Empire, he may have wore Roman clothes, he probably thought, but he wore Roman boots, his ideas were good by the time of Jesus. Yes?
Would you compare that with the United States and the other countries?
And what?
The United States and the other countries, it seems like we're still going to take it from the
United States. Yeah. Well, that's an example. That's a good example of the inability of America to cope to deal with the Middle East. The problem with the Middle East is that you get people like the Muslims. See, the reason Israel exists is because the Muslims can't live by each other on that. They can't get together. You get a group of people, for instance, who have not fought each other. Let me talk about the Jews and the Muslims. Let me talk about the Muslim nation. Who have hated each other and fought each other for almost 2,000 years. You can sit in Washington and draw all the agreements and little plans you want to. It doesn't take you around. Too many of them. They're going to be too long. It's ingrained in the nation. I'd like to meet, are you all interested in this? Maybe it's been all this time. But tomorrow, I'm very excited. We see you at the same time Friday. We're going to talk about the abomination. You can talk about the Antichrist.
No.
I want to meet for just about 1 minute or less with all the members of the Chambers family. And I always learn more from the questions I missed. number one, when Jesus was born, the great civilization of the East were in their youth and thus were ready for the fresh world view offered by the gospel. If you missed that, you can, hang yourself. They were very old, the opposite was true. Number two, Augustus restored to Rome the constitutional rule which it enjoyed the days of the Republic.
False.
What did he do?
Made it appear.
It appears a constitutional rule, but actually the Senate did not rule it either.
Well, if you wrote it down on the surface, it seemed like it was the truth.
Allen got it right.
That may teach you something about taking a test.
You can't rewrite the question.
Listen, you give yourself, count your question correct, count mine wrong. No. On all these, when you get your paper back, you know the answer. But that was the point of the question. Did he or did he not establish the constitutional rule of the servants? He did. You're right. Underneath, he didn't. But that's not what the question said. The question did not say on the servants. It would be. I'm just saying in general, I'm not jumping on you. I'm just saying in general, it's dangerous business if you have to amend the question. Put a footnote on it or rewrite it. I worked hard on these questions. Leave it alone. Number three. The age of Augustus was a time of recovered glory for Rome, but it created a social climate which was tragic for the church. Very good for the church. Later on, that's what people think. The church, by the way, but the persecution of the church did not come from the social climate in Rome. Just the general social climate that was more particularized. Number four, Augustus was determined to restore to Rome the ancient traditions which had made her great.
True.
Five, Stoicism was a popular philosophy among Romans because of the offered high standard ethics glorified the virtues of bravery, honor, and self-esteem. Number six. It's hard for the gospel to overcome the old Roman mythological religion because Augustus had restored the hearts of the people back to the ancient gods.
False.
Now, did have a religious revival. The Augustine would have any trouble with this. Which of the following authors and his major works glorified the rule of Augustus? Virgil didn't write, by the way, the Odes and the Annals. Horace wrote the Odes and passed it over the Annals. Marcus Aurelius was, what was Marcus Aurelius?
Greek.
That was a story.
When
did he live? Second century. He didn't say a word about Augustus. He was a Stoic. We studied his writings because he was a bold Stoic. Talked about the fact that in Palestine, under Antiochus Epiphanes, that his attempt to Hellenize Palestine in general, Judea, Jerusalem in particular, there was objection to the fact that Menelaus was made the high priest because he was a legitimate high priest. There was objection to the Greek social institutions, in particular the gymnasium, Saul broke the camel's back when he outlawed the Jewish religion, forbade the circumcision of children. So he called it parents that were found having circumcised their children were often crucified with their cloaks of the children strung about their necks. Then the ultimate desecration was the problem. The desecration of the temple, offering a sow on the altar. And this led to a revolt led by the house of the Hasmoneans. Royal house or aristocratic house. Later on, Judas Maccabeus became recognized in the movement. They accomplished what's called the Maccabean Freedom about 165 BC in Russia. The temple was rededicated. We recall that there was not absolute freedom. It simply forced the Seleucid leaders into allowing enough freedom to make practice their religion. And this situation more or less constantly prevailed for about 97 years. 100 years until Rome actually set up active control over the Judean state. That's why when the New Testament opens, it's Rome or Palestine, Judea, Galilee, Syria, and Samaria, this area, is under the direct rule of Rome. Okay? Do I get the picture? You have the Seleucid rule established about 200, about the Maccabean revolt about 165. This 100 years of relative freedom in Rome. Yes.
When Rome came in, how did they come in? Did they come in just forcibly fighting? Did they have to fight them completely?
They came in and conquered Jerusalem.
That's why I just wasn't sure.
They established direct military. Yeah. Actually, what they took over the area technically when they finally came in, I think it was about 65 B.C. or 67 B.C. and came in, which was the capital city of this area. Remember I said that Palestine at this time was considered, was called what? Called Lower Syria. Remember that? Full of Syria up on the board? And the capital is Antioch up here, of course. And so when they took the capital, it actually came in and took the city. Before they could give orders to Antioch, it's done where you could go and where you couldn't go. They never actually came in and took over the area until they took, after this 97 years of what's called the Maccabean period sometimes. They took the capital city, well, Antioch was the capital city of this area. And by the way, you see, later on, even after days, in the youth of Jesus, there was a time when, you see, even when Pilate was governor, which is in the head of ourselves, we'll come back to it. When Pilate was governor, he was responsible for the legate of Syria, for Antioch. Pilate was not king. He was a governor who was responsible in the line of chain of command for the legate of Syria. Roman official. That was above him. So Antioch continues to be the capital city more or less of this area. In the days of Rome. Consistently true without changes, but Rome looked at Palestine as Lower Syria. Okay, now. Yes.
I think I got this right.
Probably not.
The Maccabean Revolt, 165 B.C., they forced the Lucians to let him practice Jewish religion.
Yeah, they forced. They weren't completely afraid, but they forced the Lucians to back off.
For 100 years?
Roughly 100 years on that.
Then
the Romans conquered Antioch and took over.
About 67 B.C., right?
Yeah. It's hard to say because they didn't just come in and kind of flag them when Rome would claim rule over an area before they actually took over an area. The gradual growing power of Rome. 100 years before this, Rome had enough authority to keep Antiochus the fourth out of Egypt, a form of circling the dust. They didn't actually come in and say, "Oh, we need to take over." Yeah.
When did the Seleucids actually first have control of this area?
The exact year was 198 B.C.
Do I have 200 B.C. down here?
That's probably my fault. I try to round it off.
That's fine.
What I wanted to talk about now, and we're going to come back to this a little bit later, but this is the way, why do you go back this far? Well, you need to understand this, understand the world of the New Testament. And the thing I want to talk about now is the fact that this Maccabean revolt was a revolt not simply against the Seleucids, but it was a revolt against Hellenism. It was a revolt against the attempt to do away with the Jewish religion. It is in the nature of reactions that reactions are usually extreme. That is, the old pendulum effect. Usually go too far the other way. And in the broadest possible term, this is what happened. That the Jewish leaders reacted to this attempt to do away with the Jewish religion, to make the gymnasium the center of life in Jerusalem rather than the temple, to outlaw the circumcision, to outlaw the scriptures. They reacted in an extreme way, and this reaction we see, we have to understand this reaction to understand, for instance, the religion of the scribes and Pharisees in the New Testament. What they did was, in reacting to Hellenism, the experts say they absolutized the Torah, the technical word. You don't have to, I don't care if you remember it or not, I'm not going to answer it on a test. They absolutized the Torah. What's Torah mean? The law. Going back to that, as a part of this reaction, the leaders of the nation
The movement was called, this movement was called the Hasidic movement. Later, this developed into the Rabbinic or the Pharisaic movement.
And we get the ability to take the class history of biblical interpretation of Bill speaking. We talk about this. But the what they did was they went back to reestablish the minds of the people, the old path. It was a revival. But the revival that went too far. And calling people back to the law, they absolutized the Torah. That is, they made the Torah the absolute and only standard of life. They tried to make a Palestine theocracy again in terms of the law, the Torah. Because, you see, and three great institutions, three great foundations of Judaism came to the front. There was the Torah, the law, we call it the Pentateuch sometimes. There was the temple. There was the synagogue. Nobody's quite sure when the synagogue actually came into existence. It used to be days of the synagogue in existence. To understand what they did with the law, maybe I'm not making myself very clear, to understand what they did with the law, you have to understand two things. Number one, you have to understand that they were reacting against an attempt to eradicate the law. And there was still a Hellenistic faction in Jerusalem. It wasn't instantly done away with. There were many Jews who wanted to do away with the law, become great Greeks, in effect. Mr. Udell, you want to doff your chapeau? The second thing you need to know is that they it was not a simple thing to call people back to the law, because the world in which they were living was not the kind of world into which the law originally came. See, the law was given, Israel was born in the wilderness, the tabernacle was the center of their lives. Even when they rural, they were decentralized, the tribes. Well, the rural simply was not like that anymore. The world, because the Jews had become more urbanized. What does that mean? City dwellers. A number of factors, not the least of which was the Babylonian captivity, when they could not own land, had created a large merchant class, commercial class within the Jews. That is, there were not a bunch of farmers anymore living out in the bush. They were Greek-speaking, urbanized, and commercial, that is, wealthy trading people, we call bankers. And it was very difficult to adapt the law to the new thing, the new world, the cosmopolitan world. That is, what was the Sabbath day's journey? They see, Sabbath day's journey decided that the only place you could go on the Sabbath was where? It was given. Only place you could go on the Sabbath day. Go to the tabernacle and back. So they estimated the distance from the father's camp of the encampment to the tabernacle and back, and that was the Sabbath day's journey. But they didn't have a tabernacle anymore. And people weren't living, weren't camping about the tabernacle. Where were they living? They were living all over the place. Well, they were 100 miles, 200 miles away in some cases. So they'll tell this.
fire out.
You didn't have to say, don't put the fire out to work. But if he was going, but you couldn't ask him to. Now, if a Jewish child, a minor, came in, you had to tell him to leave the fire alone. Because that might be work. But they also said, you're on a ship, and it's time to get off the ship. You can't put the gangplank down to walk off the ship. You just have to end up in the water and wade ashore, because that's putting the gangplank down is work. However, if a Gentile puts the gangplank down, you can walk over it. As long as you didn't put it down for you. You know, if he said to you, here, I'll put the gangplank down for you, then you couldn't get to get it. Even though the gangplank down, you had to jump over the side and swim ashore, because he did it for you. And see, that might be like, even though you didn't work, somebody did it for you, that might break the law. So he put the hedge way out here, so that as long as he didn't know you were going to walk over it, the gangplank was already down, the Gentile didn't know you were going to walk down on it, then you can walk down on it. But if he had you in mind to put the gangplank down, you couldn't use it. Now you see, the Mishnah, the whole thing is the hedge.
The whole thing?
Yeah. The Mishnah, this kind of thing is the Gemara and the Talmud, they're all the hedge. The Mishnah is the beginning, the primary, the core Gemara. Gemara is a comment on the Mishnah. Seriously. See, the law is this big, the Torah. The Mishnah is this thing. It's a comment on the law. And the Gemara, this thing, is a comment on the Mishnah. The Talmud is about 12 volumes.
What they call the rabbinic development.
Yes, rabbinic is the adjective on the fly there. Yes.
If they had a hedge around the law where you couldn't, if you put the law, they have to have the law behind those absolute truths.
Yes, first they defined the law. And then it couldn't get stopped, so they, that was the Mishnah. And since their commentary was bigger than the law, there was more rules in the Mishnah than there was in the law. Then they couldn't get stopped, in the Mishnah, there are some things that weren't quite thoroughly interpreted and defined. So the Gemara interpreted the Mishnah, commented on the Mishnah. Very, very interesting. They ruled that you could chew on peppercorn for the breath or whatever, finger teeth. They said if you had a piece of peppercorn in your mouth when the sun went down on Friday and the Sabbath began, you could keep it in there. But you couldn't, after the sun went down, you couldn't put a piece of, that would be vanity, violate the Sabbath. If you had false teeth, they had false teeth in the ancient world. If you had, on the Sabbath, you had gold false teeth, you couldn't wear them on the Sabbath because they were vanity. But if you had wooden false teeth, it looked like sin anyway. You could wear those. So that's, that's for chewing. They figured if you got that wooden place, in other words, you could chew, but you could not enhance your appearance. Your teeth do two things. They have to chew and they enhance your appearance. And so the law, what they decided was that it was okay to have teeth to chew on the Sabbath, but not to enhance your appearance. So you could have, and if you're just going to chew wooden teeth, you're good enough. So you wear your wooden false teeth on the Sabbath. You had to chew your food, but not your gold. Ivory. Well, anyway, I don't want to get any more time on that, but you see, this is what Jesus was talking about when he said, you have made the law of none effect by your tradition. His tradition was his head. You see, and this is why Jesus, who never broke the law, often stomped down the hedge. Because the law was the word of God and the hedge wasn't. For instance, the disciples were walking along the Sabbath day, and according to the law, they were taking grain, there was a law say that you could not square off your field. You had to leave them rounded off to the traveler and the poor person walking along and hungry. They didn't have restaurants every 3 miles in the ancient world. There was no problem traveling. They left grain on the field, and the law said if you're traveling along, you could, as long as you were on the roadbed, you could reach over to the grain and get whatever, pick whatever was available.
like the laws, you know, it came over your side of the fence, but you couldn't leave the roadway and go and harvest. And it was a Sabbath, so they were walking along and doing this, rolling the grain in their hands. Somebody were condemned of what? Well, you're harvesting. No, they weren't. They didn't break the law. We're eating. But they had decided, what they had decided was, there's no question, if you go out in the field and work on the Sabbath, you're breaking the law. But, you see, if you pass a rule that says you can't even roll, you know, some wheat between, every this in the farm, you take the wheat, you roll your hands, you blow it, blow the shaft away, you need the grain. That's how it was. Well, you know, this walking, well, they were harvesting, they were eating, you know, like you were starving. And so they said, look, if we outlaw that, see, then a man who would never, even if he were hungry, traveling along, you know, on the Sabbath now, reach over and get some grain heads and rub them between his hands and eat them. He would never do that. It's a sure thing he would never go out in the field and harvest. So we will make the rule that he can't even do that. That'll make sure that he doesn't harvest. You see that? Do you see the theory behind this? Yes.
Could they even travel on the Sabbath?
Yes, but not very far. They depended, you see. And they had all kinds of silly rules. And they worked out, and by the way, they had this worked out. Once they got the swing of this, they really got the spirit of it. They worked out all kinds of traditions that enabled you to break the law if you wanted to, by some strange paradox or reversal of theory. It's strange, but for instance, Jesus said, "By the law you have broken by, but you develop one traditions. You develop so many traditions in connection with one law that you end up breaking another one." But what clear example did Jesus give of this?
The yeast of corn.
Yes. They would dedicate, they would say, it's all dedicated to God, therefore I don't have to do what with it.
You make them mother and father.
Take care of my mother and father. Well, there was this whole system. I don't want to get into that, but I want to see, you have to understand this, to understand the Jews of the first century. Now the Pharisees, while the Pharisees are the bad guys, you should call somebody a Pharisee, you haven't said something good about them. However, the Pharisees, by Jesus' time, were the proprietors of this system, which had gotten out of hand. But you have to understand that the Pharisees in their beginnings, in this intertestamental period, were the good guys. They did save the law, as it were, from the Hellenistic influences. But what I want us to see is that this, which Jesus came up against time and time again, was the tradition of the Pharisees. But this was the result, after 100 years or so, of a process that began when the leaders of the Jewish nation in Palestine tried to do what? Tried to say, to resist this trend against Hellenism, and want to destroy the Jewish religion if they could. Secondly, to adapt the law, to interpret the law so it could be obeyed in a world that was different from the world in which the law was given. We had the same problem today by New Testament exegesis. Trying to reproduce the first century church. Did the first century church, for instance, meet at 9:30 in the morning for Bible school, 10:30 in the morning worship, sing the doxology 5,000 times a year, and have church buildings and order of worship just the way we do? How do you really know that? Those are my... Oh, you want to go back here to century? How did the early church, the first century church, partake of the Lord's Supper? When did it partake of
it?
During the love feast. Wasn't part of what we call the worship service at all, part of the fellowship supper. You ever had fellowship supper, and then an evening service, or a morning service, and all day meeting dinner on the ground? If you've been the first century church, when the church began, they took the Lord's Supper with the fellowship supper, not with the singing and the preaching. Do you know that? Well, point is, and this is a cultural adaptation, but how do you do it, you see? How do you interpret the New Testament, the principles, so that we, in our culture, in our day, it's not like the world of the New Testament, how do we follow the biblical pattern? I'm simply saying here, it's a real problem. So don't picture this Hasidic rabbinic Pharisaic movement as a bad problem. When it started, it was good. They were meeting a real need. They were doing what we would call a good thing. They simply got carried away. They couldn't get stopped.
This has put us in a pretty good idea, but they kill the lawbreaker or the head breaker.
Yes, but they could.
In this case, it would be wrong. It's all right, like you said, it's all right in some cases when they had a head.
Well, were basically dangerous. Now, on a personal basis, it's good. I'll give you an example. Now, do you have any guidance for me? How about the day of the street? I'd like it much from more street. What's wrong with the principle? Well, when you talk about theological legislation, you might call it, when you start drawing up rules for general conduct, then the hedge always gets you in trouble. Now, as far as a personal ethic, that you simply apply to yourself and to no one else, I think it's very good. For instance, we do something like this when we say, and Paul taught something about this on a personal basis, if I'm not legislating for anybody else. In Romans 14, a little bit of the hedge. That is, if meat causes my brother to stumble, what? I'll not eat meat. Because eating meat is wrong? No, because if I do, there's a possibility I will do damage that's not, and it's not worth it. You know, sometimes the price we pay is not worth the benefit we get.
The, who was it? One of the ancient authors spoke of a man who went fishing with a golden hook. Christians do this all the time. We're fishing with a golden hook. What's wrong with fishing with a golden hook?
You don't need to be fishing.
What?
You need to hook?
Yeah, so I am about the principle.
What you stand to lose is more than what you stand to gain. Fishing with a golden hook, you stand to lose what? A golden hook. You stand to gain what?
A fish.
So what you stand to gain is not worth what you stand to lose. That was the principle. And many Christians have learned the lesson of the golden hook. Often, we participate in all kinds of questionable practices, and questionable compromises, ethical compromises in our lives, because it's fun or whatever we want to, not realizing that what we gain by it does not even come close to what we stand to lose by it. That's the principle of the hedge. That is what Paul said. I'm not going to fish the boat. In other words, do I like meat?
Yeah.
If you like, you're raised on pork chops, you say this is the dinner. You're raised on pork chops, bacon, all, you know, penguin. But, you see, if it caused your brother to stumble, it really hurts his faith. What you gain by it, which is what? The enjoyment of meat, which is not wrong in and of itself, is more than what you stand to lose by it. What? A brother. So you find it's kind of a hedge. And so he calls upon people to make this a personal decision. I mean, I think a wise Christian does this. A wise Christian will create some hedges in his life. Certain things, I don't want to teach my children to gamble. Therefore, we don't allow playing cards in our house. We play rook and old maid. You say, well, that's not consistent. I know. But I'm not talking the word of God, I'm talking about a hedge. It's my hedge. My hedge, I'll play where I want it. That's fine. See, so I've got a little hedge. I just don't get my kids used to playing cards. And therefore, I think by this, I'm not into, I don't need to. You know, you say, well, maybe why not? You know, we'll take a Christmas and New Year's. Anyway. So, is there anything wrong with that? You see, if I start telling you, though, that you can't do it, see, I make you walk around my hedge, then that was the problem with this system. See, that was, the idea of the hedge is not bad on a personal basis. I think we ought to build some hedges in our life. But my hedge, since I start making you walk around my hedge, then you got what you got with the Pharisees.
A lot of people do that today. Yeah. Would the bylaws that a lot of the churches have today fall into...
Yes, bylaws are, by and large, hedges. Well, not bylaws, constitutions. The constitution and bylaws. I got a theory about it. I'm going to the church ought to have constitutions. The New Testament church constitution. I think I ought to have bylaws to state when he calls meetings and what days you meet and what the procedures are. My thing about bylaws is this. The only time bylaws ever get written, somebody's mad at each other. I think a church ought to have an excellent set of bylaws, have a good set of bylaws, have a lawyer draw them up, make sure they're excellent. They ought not be more than 2 pages long. Make one copy, give it to the chairman of the board, he ought to lose it.
Amen.
I think I'll be ready for 25 years.
Right.
And then
without fail, every 25 years. Go ahead, as long as that go by, read about it, every 25 years. Every generation want to hear them, for us. But this would be an example. And you have heads thinking, for instance, some churches, if you have somebody beside an elder, pray at the table. You know, you violate the will of God. That's a head. Does the Bible say that? There's a connection between who prays at the table and the eldership in the New Testament. And the Irish and a connection whatever, which is a hedge building. And people have all kinds of hedges. You know, people have hedges. So I don't know if this may be interesting to you, but it is not really off the subject, because this is the very thing we see in the New Testament, that Jesus rejected this. He rejected the hedges that the Pharisees, by this time, had defined a hedge that they just couldn't get stopped. And he rejected this thing, and they tried to impose it on other people. Any question? Do you understand what I'm talking about? A Christian won't build some hedges, I think, is stupid. You say, this is your attitude. The Bible doesn't say it's wrong, I can do it. You know, if I can't find book, chapter, and verse that says it's wrong, then I can do it. If that's your attitude, then you don't have the foggiest notion what Christianity is all about. You need to be converted. You need to be converted from Judaism. Christianity. You need to be converted from law to grace. And I'll be glad to baptize you.
Father said, I can't do this.
Well, by the way, I've written that with the testimony.
Meaning if you're building personal edges, it's the same effect of the people, right?
Personal edges. Now, I think a good hedge, I think total abstinence is a good hedge. But the Bible teaches, absolutely under no circumstances, you can not take a drink, doesn't say that. However, it's interesting. What about social drinking? Well, social drinking does not violate any biblical law against what you take in your body. It does violate the biblical ethic of wisdom. But the primary sin a person drinks is not drunkenness, it's stupidity. And the Bible commands us to be wise. Anybody who drinks socially today is a perfect fool. That's necessary to do? No. Does it taste good? No, if you mix it with something, or you're going to get stuck down. What if your mom's out here sweating, you know, walk around taking anesthetics? Complete violation of the Christian ethic. Anybody thinks they can do it, just is violating the biblical command to be wise. Anyway. Well, so what you do, in other words, what I'm saying is that hedge building, a little personal hedge building, is a wise thing. But you can't tell somebody else's head. Well, and this is what this system was in the simplest terms. And it was very serious because Jesus, it was the center, it was the talking point of much of the opposition to Jesus, which had a big part in the crucifixion. Yes?
What happened when someone wants to build a head around you? What do you do? And they say, I want to build, I think you should fit this more than you would do. Then I'll build it too.
Not necessarily. The only time you walk over something, you're advised, the only time you do something like that in their experience is when you have to in order to obey the commandments of God. But you don't do it just because it's there. Jesus didn't do that. You mentioned Jesus observed many of the traditions of the Pharisees. Because it didn't make any difference one way or the other. It's only when the traditions of the Pharisees kept him from doing the will of God that he tore down the hedge. It wasn't necessary. Well, they couldn't. Well, right. That's a good point. There were God's own. It wasn't a necessity. Jesus apparently had told them, okay, but it's a good question. That's a good point. We had to modify my generalization.
The way it was Sunday.
Wrong.
Well, what they had constructed was the system. It's impossible to keep all this. It's impossible to really stay outside the head. It's impossible to do so. And Jesus said that they what did Jesus say? These fellows tie burdens on people's backs that nobody can carry. By the time they got through, it's impossible to get through the day without violating something.
Let me throw picky in the rule of
To Phil's question or statement there about they could go hungry, with this teaching that from Matthew's 15th chapter, Jesus said, told them that Isaiah had prophesied well of them, saying, "You draw near me with your mouth and honor me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. In vain do you worship me, teaching the doctrine and commandments of men." And I think that's something that we should really think about when we want to teach our own dogmas.
That's right. And Scotty raises a good point about it by Jesus' time. See, when they started out, this was recognized as not the law, but the hedge. Got this? But by Jesus' time, they thought the law was out here. That is, in their mind, they came to identify the hedge with the Word of God, the will of God. And this is what Scotty was talking about. But they didn't say, "Well, let's do this so we don't break the law." They were saying, "This is the law." Jesus said, "It isn't." You're teaching for commandments, what? The doctrines of men. It's exactly what he's taught. You're teaching as if it were the Word of God, but it isn't. It's such a man-made rule.
Wouldn't it be the exact same thing now with, you know, the general consensus of most preachers say that if you smoke a cigarette, if you smoke, you're more to hell. Isn't that the same thing?
Exactly. Yeah, anybody said that because the Bible doesn't say that. But it violates the ethic. For instance, anybody today who smokes in the light of all that is known about smoking is foolish. When I talk to my teenagers about dancing and drinking and smoking, I don't say to them, if you go to one dance, make one cigarette, drink one bottle of beer, you're going to hell. I point out this is a very foolish way to live. The Bible commands us to be wise. Now, if you do this to the extreme, then you begin to violate definite commandments. And against drunkenness, against destruction of the body, against violating your brother's conscience, and anything, and sex, eventually, fornication, because the dance is sexual foreplay. Dancing is nothing more than sexual. I'm a square dancer. Dancing, you ask any expert on the field. I'm talking about Christians. I'm talking about those who know what dancing is. It's sexual foreplay. But the music, there's nothing more than that. Nothing less than that. It's always been that. If you read the experts on it, from the world, and ask them what it is, they'll tell you. I've got the books I can show you. They have no question about it. You see, and they laugh at the Christian who acts like it's something else. Just fun. Or just have a good time. Just fellowship. And the devil, those who really understand that, who know the subject, who know what it's all about, they just laugh their heads off, these foolish Christians. Well, anyway, the problem is very foolish. They're foolish. So, but you see, what you teach it for what it is, not for what it is. You don't teach it as a commandment, explicit command on that or against it, it's not there. But you do teach it as it fits into what the Bible does say. Yeah.
If the Mishnah was the hedge around the law, and you came around about 200 AD, what kind of hedge do they have around the law during practice?
Good question. No, the 200 AD represents when it was written. Excellent question. Do you know what Kimberly asked? If it was written 200 AD, what are we talking about in Jesus' time? Now you see, this, I didn't get into this, and I should have.
This concept, this hedge, if you say to them, where did it come from? That they would say from God. He said, well, it's not in the Bible. Here's how they, what did they say, Gail? Where did this come from? If it came from God. Yes. What they taught, now this doctrine was not taught in the beginning. This doctrine sort of grew to justify. What they taught was that when Moses went to Mount Sinai, he received the written law, which we have in the Torah, but then he received another law, which was the oral law. And so by its very nature, and the written law was to be passed down in written documents, tablets and stone. The oral law was to be passed down word of mouth
obviously, from one generation to the next. And so what they said was, this is the written law, and this is the oral law. Well, by being oral, you see, Mr. Thompson, by being oral, by definition, it would be very slow to write it down. But it was very much known and practiced. It was just, you just didn't write it down. It was oral law. Well, this, eventually, they got around to writing it down. Excellent question. Y'all see what I'm saying? So it was there. It just was not written down in a volume.
And this was the reason that it was conceived that it wasn't an unwritten law. But still the law of God. Now this idea that it was the law of God came along, that was growing about the time of Jesus. It was already there. Nobody got up, you didn't have a committee get up one morning and say, hey, let's start thinking this way. Let's start thinking about the oral law. Let's start looking at it. And it didn't happen. It gradually evolved. A long period of time. But it began with the Maccabean revolt. You see that? It began as a revival to preserve the law in the minds of the people. And it just simply got carried away. And by the way, this traditionalism, and I've already shot me out when I sat a half hour behind now. It's all your fault. this way, now you see this in Roman Catholicism. And all the church, the religion, just works this way. But I think if we understand this, it'll help us. For instance, one of the many things our churches need today, we need to get rid of some conditions. If we don't get rid of some hedges pretty soon, we're not the younger, the next generation, the generation coming along, is not going to be reached by the gospel at all. At all.
ask Professor Bourne. He's in charge of practical reality. what you call it? Hedging. But so you're talking about civil equal fans, you're talking about it. Yes.
No, we just seven held it. We were part of it.
The what?
Shema.
Shema. Well, the Shema came to be considered through this period, through all this. It's hard to locate exactly when. Came to be the fundamental statement of Judaism, because they were reacting again to this Hellenism, held many gods. And Mishner, in his book, The Source, tells about this old man who, this is a historical fiction, but it captured the spirit of the time, when in this community they gradually passed more and more laws against the Jewish religion. First, you couldn't circumcise your children, or then you. Well, first, you couldn't. You had to regularly pay homage to the image of Antiochus, but you could still go to the synagogue. And then later, you couldn't circumcise your children, but you go to the synagogue. And later on, you could read the law of certain. And you gradually whittled away, and the people in the community were being, gradually deprived of their faith. And finally, one old man drew the line. He said, "No, no." And so the authorities skinned him alive and burned him. And his last words were, "Shema Israel, Adonai Elohim, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." In Deuteronomy 6:4, that's right here. Mm-hmm. Okay. 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 They came, the Shema, he asked him to put up the Shema. The Shema came to be the sort of the... Six, four. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And so, you see, this came to be the sort of the theme verse for this whole movement, because they're reacting to paganism and said, many gods, this was the thing that set, this was the foremost thing that set apart Israel from paganism. God is one. And the Shema means, in Hebrew, you all know this, but the Shema is in Hebrew, this is the word for this word. This is an imperative. This is an imperative verb. It's Shema, which is a commandment. Hear, commandment, imperative. Hear, O Israel, the first word in this verse. Shema Israel, hear, O Israel, and it came to be called the Shema. Because it's a simple translation of this word. That word. Is that what you asked me? Hard to pin it down. Mission maybe a little bit early in putting it this far back as Antiochus, but
He goes to Ephesus, he goes to the synagogue, 1 Thessalonians. He goes to Micah, he goes to the synagogue. He goes to Corinth, he goes to the synagogue. Now, in the days of the dispersion, as near as are the days of the New Testament, in the world of the New Testament, as near as can be guessed, there were more Jews in northern Egypt, Alexandria in particular, than there were in Palestine. In the first century. Of the five districts of Alexandria, two of them were Jewish. And there were more Jews in what's called Babylonia, the Mesopotamian Valley, the east, than there were in Palestine. Probably.
How many of the king was in AD 70 when the ultimate
dispersion? Well, Titus, the Roman general, took. Yes. Just to the east, and then it's called Babylonia, but not the Mesopotamian Valley. And there were Jews throughout the Mediterranean world. As far as Rome, there were no Jews in the first century west of Rome. That came later. So they were, and Rome had a heavy Jewish population. So at that time, it's a safe saying that in the days of Jesus, in the days of the apostles, if you took all the Jews out of Rome, and they did it every so often, took all the slaves out of Rome, you wouldn't have enough people left to get up a bridge game. Start an argument. Well, there was that's extreme, but there were. The point is that they really, the slave population, the Jewish population, were more of those than were Romans in Rome. More slaves, because many of the Jews, it's kind of confusing, because many of the Jews were Roman citizens, but most of them weren't. Paul was a Roman citizen, but he was an exception. It's interesting, you notice that when they found out that Paul was a Jew, they assumed that he was not a Roman citizen. Didn't they? That was a natural assumption because very few of the Jews were Roman citizens. Now, this is very important, of course, to say the book of Acts. We meet the Jews of Palestine in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But we meet the Jews of the Hellenistic Jews and the Jews of the diaspora in the book of Acts. Now, these are called, there's this thing of Hellenistic Judaism is important because the world of the New Testament was a Hellenistic world. That is, the culture, even though it was ruled by Rome, the culture was Greek for the most part. That is, because of the long tenure of the Hellenistic empires from the days of Alexander the Great down to the rise of Rome, because we've said a number of times, the Greek, for instance, even though in later years, Latin became a universal language in the West. That's up in the Middle Ages when Latin was an international language. Not so. Even when Latin was the international language, even the second, third, and fourth centuries after Christ, when Latin was the international language in the West, Greek was still the international language in the East. From Rome East in Greek. Of course, the early church fathers wrote in Greek. Up through Nicaea. Now, Tertullian developed, and others, especially Tertullian, developed the Latin literature. But it played second fiddle. And even up through the Middle Ages, Greek still held sway over Latin. So, by the way, these international languages, there have been six international languages in the history of the world. Greek was one. Latin was an international language in medieval Europe. French was an international language later on in the 18th century. when Napoleon took Moscow and lost it, even before Napoleon, it was anybody who's in the, for instance, in the court of the Tsars of Russia, the court language, the official language was French.
She spoke Russian, they looked down on her. She was in Russia. They looked down their nose at you if you spoke Russian. One of the Russian dialects, but she spoke Francis. And by the way, English is international. But if you go anywhere in the world, they study English. Perfect. Yeah.
Well, that's it. I get four. There's Greek, Latin, French, and English.
Mm-hmm. Number six. Akkadian. The others go farther on back. Akkadian was one of them in the national language. And I think if you go way back to Sumerian, you can go back to Sumerian.
Was Latin the main language of the Romans? Is that how it got to be the main language?
Well, see, over the cross of Jesus, they wrote, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews," in what three languages? Greek, Latin, Aramaic. Aramaic because it was a local dialect. Rome because it was the official language of the government. And Greek because that's what everybody spoke. Probably anybody coming in. Well, you see, it's an international language, by the way. You all hear a lot of confusion concerning the day of Pentecost. How many they were speaking in languages? These men, we hear a man speaking in the language when we were born. And then it goes off and names them, the 14 names or whatever, second chapter of Acts. And then Peter, they said, well, when Peter got up, and I heard a preacher, described this one time, well, there's one of the apostles over here speaking to this group in this language, and they go through, and he was speaking in tongues. And they said, had a little group gathered around, and they're all speaking in tongues. It's silly, of course. First place, there didn't have to be very many tongues spoken, because those were local dialects, but there were not that many represented. There were people in different places, but not that many languages everything. Latin. Secondly, the book of Acts only mentions Peter getting up and speaking, because he's the only one who got up and spoke. You know, they were all people from all over the world, Jews from all over the world, but in all these dialects, and Peter got up and preached, he preached in Greek, and they all understood him. They were bilingual. Didn't need to speak in tongues, and preach. There's no evidence, no one ever preached in tongues. That was the purpose of it. Y'all see that? There was a Peter got up and preached in Greek. They all understood. They would understand their local dialects, where they came from. Understand Greek. Well, anyway, this heavily influenced the Hellenistic world, affected the Jews of dispersion, so that what we find is a brand of Judaism, which is still Judaism now, but it is not, it is so distinct that it has been classified traditionally by historians as Hellenistic Judaism. It is Judaism. Now listen to me. It is Judaism, but it is not the Pharisaic Judaism that we meet in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's the important thing to know. We've already discussed all that I'm going to discuss. Pharisaic Judaism, because yesterday, the hedge building, their approach. But you got this? It was Judaism, but it was not the Pharisaic Judaism or the Palestinian Judaism of the gospel narratives. Now, Judaism was viewed by Rome as just one more oriental cult. Interestingly enough, the early view of the church, until Rome woke up too late to realize the difference, they thought that the church was simply one more Jewish sect. So Rome treated Judaism as just one more oriental cult, and they treated the church as just a branch of Judaism in the beginning, in the days in the world of the New Testament, in the book of Acts. That's why one of the reasons the Romans, they didn't realize what was going on until it was too late, until the gospel had turned the world upside down. But they thought it was just these crazy Jews acting up. They don't know what the Jews are going to do. There's another crazy, another Messiah, another holy man. The time his name is Jesus. And we've had it all before. And one reason they thought they could put it down with persecution. Well, it's worked before. And so that was their view. Now, as far as the church initially spread by using the institutions, the synagogue in particular, of the Hellenistic Jews, or the Jews of the dispersion. It became the sort of the touchstone of the spread there of a church. Now, concerning this, by the way, if you're interested in reading, I'd like to read from initial primers. This is Philo, who was the first century Jewish
Alexandrian philosopher.
He wrote this: "For so populous are the Jews that no